This works.
I thought tonight, since it's about to be Thanksgiving, that I would talk about holidays and difficult relationships and my sense of being a bad Buddhist at family gatherings. So first let me go back to what we read. What we read in the Bodhisattva's Vow. Where Tore Enji says this so beautifully. He says, how can we be ungrateful to anyone or anything? Even though someone may be a fool, we can be compassionate. If someone turns against us, speaking ill of us and treating us bitterly, it's best to bow down. This is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments, the very ones that have made us suffer again and again and again. So, I think all of us in our lives have people who we find hard to deal with. And some of those people come to Thanksgiving dinner. Some of those people show up in our offices. Some of those people show up on the street. For me, there is one cousin who shows up at Thanksgiving and who I find very difficult. This is a man with extremely strong opinions on the opposite end of the political spectrum from my own, who talks nonstop, loves to engage in political discourse. It usually gets very heated. People usually glaze over pretty quickly. Everyone gets very quiet, and then there's a long discourse from my cousin. And I find myself getting angrier and angrier, and then I find myself remembering Tore Enji's lines and saying, yes, it's best to bow down, but I can't bow down because I'm getting so angry and I'm feeling really bad about myself and really bad about my cousin. And it's just this swirl of judgment. Certainly judgment of self, along with judgment of my poor relative, and a lot of suffering. And I think, well, what does this practice have to teach us about that? And I learned something about that suffering this past spring, not from a relative or a coworker, but from the rabbits in my garden. We have a garden that we really like, and we're kind of proud of it. And there was a real upsurge of the rabbit population in Newton this past spring. And so all these beautiful little buds were coming out in April and May, and the rabbits were just eating them as fast as they came out. And I was just heartbroken, because I loved the garden, I loved these buds. And the rabbits would just happily eat, and of course they know that they have no natural predators among the residents of Newton. So when I try to shoo them away, they just stand and look at me and then continue munching. Well, I found myself, again, getting really furious, really judgmental at these little rabbits. And I found we read the Peter Rabbit books, where, you know, Peter Rabbit is, and all the little bunnies are such nice little rabbits, and Mr. McGregor is the mean man who wants to shoo the rabbits away and wants to hurt them. I began to feel like Mr. McGregor. I wanted these rabbits. So I started reading online about the rabbits and about how to keep them out of your garden. And in fact, there were some compounds you could use that might keep the rabbits away. Now, they might kill the rabbits, but they would definitely keep the rabbits away. So I was reading about this and really thinking about it, and suddenly I stopped and I thought, here I am, a Zen priest, thinking about poisoning bunnies. This was like, clearly, something was wrong. And what I began to understand was how completely attached I was to these rabbits being something that they were not, being different from who they were. How dare they show up as they were in the universe, in my garden, and eat the things that they wanted to eat? And the absurdity of it began to make me actually very happy. And I was able to come to a place where I realized that they were going to eat what they ate, and the garden would be what it was, and that was it. So we had some very decimated looking little shrubs and some other things that bloomed nicely, and life went on. But I began to realize that my approach to many people in my life was not so different from my initial take on the rabbits, which was, how dare they show up in the way that they are? How dare they be who they are and not the way I want them to be? And I began to notice more and more in my practice about how much I wanted people to be different, certainly wanted myself to be different, and how, in many subtle ways as well as not so subtle ways, I simply was not able to be interested in and curious about the many manifestations of the Buddha in the universe. In fact, there's a great quote from John Tarrant that I actually used many mornings in meditation as I was worrying about the rabbits and worrying about difficult people. John Tarrant said, "Most projects to change other people or ourselves are really projects about interior decoration for the prison. A spiritual practice is really about jailbreaking." And what I found was that when I gave up some of my projects for changing myself and other people, that there was a sense of release. And what I realized was that as I began to approach these old relationships, long-standing relationships with this cousin, with a coworker I have difficulty with, when I began to approach them with a beginner's mind, not all the time, but when I could, that things shifted. And there's a piece from Hongzhi, the 12th century Zen master who actually Kate read a piece from last time, that I also found extremely helpful in this regard. He titles it "Self and Other the Same." Imagine if we could bring this mind to difficult relationships. All dharmas are innately amazing beyond description. Perfect vision has no gap. In mountain groves, grasslands, and woods, the truth has always been exhibited. I would add, in my cousin, the truth has always been exhibited. Discern and comprehend the broad, long tongue of Buddha's teaching, which cannot be muted anywhere. The spoken is instantly heard. What is heard is instantly spoken. Senses and objects merge. Principle and wisdom are united. When self and other are the same, mind and dharmas are one. When you face what you have excluded and see how it appears, you must quickly gather it together and integrate with it. Make it work within your house. And what I notice in the moments when I can actually do this is that many things emerge that have been hidden by my stories that I tell myself about these relationships. I look at my cousin, and I see, when I let the words just come at me, I see a person who's actually quite afraid because he's not being listened to, and he's terrified that he's not being seen for who he is. And I can begin to resonate with that fear. I begin to see myself and the stories I tell myself about how I'm supposed to enjoy this or at least have compassion for it when I don't always have compassion for it. And that too is just the Buddha arising in me. And I certainly see the dance that my cousin and I do, where he becomes more and more talkative, I become more quiet and more angry. And here we are, these two little waves in this vast ocean, just baffled by each other, but completely interconnected in this dance that we do. It doesn't mean that I don't still find myself getting frustrated and angry. It means that I act on it less. It means that I find sometimes more skillful means with which to respond. So with the rabbits, I'm learning about plants that rabbits don't like to eat. And those are some of the plants we're going to be putting in this coming spring. With my cousin, he likes to watch action movies. So instead of sitting around after Thanksgiving dinner talking, we're going to watch action movies. But what Tore Enji tells us is something that I think we can all do when we have the space to do it. Not all the time, but some of the time. Again, how can we be ungrateful to anyone or anything? Even though someone may be a fool, we can be compassionate. Even though I may be a fool, I can be compassionate. If someone turns against us, speaking ill of us and treating us bitterly, it's best to bow down. This is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments, the very ones that have made us suffer again and again and again. So we ask ourselves, what are we attached to? Is it a Thanksgiving dinner without a political monologue? If so, what's so important about that attachment? Is it a coworker who treats us in a very particular way? What about that attachment? And what happens if I'm able to let that attachment go? All of that is based in this sense that we are completely interconnected, that we arise together, that we are all manifestations of Buddha nature, and that as we recognize this, we suffer less and we create more harmony in the world. And so my wish for you this Thanksgiving is that you bring beginner's mind to you, these old, old relationships, and just see what happens. See all the things that arise as you face toward these things as if for the first time. Happy Thanksgiving. So thoughts? Yeah. Hi, Claudia. Welcome back.
Nice to see you all.
Yeah.
So when you say beginner's mind, it's like without having any preconceptions, without telling yourself any stories about that particular situation or person or rabbits, right? Just start fresh.
It's when we can let the stories sort of set them aside a little bit, when I can really, you know, I hear my cousin's monologue and I immediately, a whole thing kicks in for me. I feel the knot in my stomach. I start to shut, my ears close, I don't hear. But what if I really watch? What if I really look? And I get interested again as though I've never met this person before. And you learn new things. And I learn new things about me.
And it is interesting how, for me at work, because that's where I met most new people, you know, you start with this vision, tunnel vision, and then you discover a person. So someone who originally may not be, not your best friend, but you wouldn't agree, in time you if you have the beginner's mind and if you allow yourself to move past some little things that maybe don't resonate resonate in you. Mm. And then you discover this wonderful person with whom you have so much more in common than you ever thought.
And you become so much more interesting to them.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
And it happens again and again and
yeah.
again.
Yeah.
If you allow.
Yeah.
Except the three of us, so that's going to be our very small.
But that's a practice that can happen right there at home with the nuclear family. Oh.
When you say bow down, I don't understand what that means.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Because do they mean literally bow down? I mean, my cousin would think I lost my mind.
I thought it was metaphorical, but I couldn't quite catch
yeah,
that
it is metaphorical. So what they're really talking about is bowing down to just this, to the reality of everything that's arising in the moment. So it's bowing down to the vastness of the... So the dharmas are the 10,000 things, just whatever is. So whatever is includes the words coming at me, the food on the table, the ache in my back, the knot in my stomach.
You mean accept?
Accept.
Accept, okay.
Accept. And not try to leave anything out. And that's really... The bowing is really a kind of acceptance. Mm-hmm. Rather, because what... A lot of what makes us suffer is trying to push things away. Push away the reality that rabbits eat shrubs. That's just what happens. I can get so caught up in trying to keep things out. So that's what, it's a bowing and an allowing. Yeah, man.
You know, I was wondering, two questions. One is, are enlightened people able to have preferences? And my second question is, are enlightened people able to have moral views?
Hmm. Well, what you're talking about is a state of enlightenment that what we think about in Zen is really that enlightenment is a process and it's a continual evolving. So there's no place that we get to where we say now I'm an enlightened person. Never happens. But there are moments where we are sufficiently aligned with the universe and the greater self that we are more enlightened beings. And then there are moments when we're not. But then can an enlightened being have preferences? Yes. We're going to have preferences as long as we're alive. The difference is how attached we are to them. So no, I don't like it when the rabbits eat the shrubs. That's still a preference. But I'm not going to poison them. I'm not that attached to the shrubs, if that makes sense. So that I like chocolate ice cream better than vanilla. But if vanilla is the only thing that's on offer, I like ice cream. I'll have vanilla. That makes sense. So that we, of course, preferences are not a problem. It's the attachment and the suffering. If I suffer every time a rabbit takes a little bite of one of my shrubs, that's an attachment that's causing me harm, that's causing me suffering.
Okay, so you can have preferences, but if those preferences, if those preferences become desires, then it's a problem?
If they make you suffer, if you can't let them go. After Catherine Senga said her new little slogan she says to herself is, let go or be dragged. And, you know, the question is, are they dragging us? Are our preferences dragging us in an unpleasant way? As opposed to simply something we can enjoy. That in fact, preferences can be something very enjoyable in life. Certain kinds of music you love. What's wrong with that? Yeah.
It's funny you asked that because I was thinking about the first one and everything you tried. I was reading one of these precepts on books on precepts, I figured, by a woman, so I don't remember the page because I just opened it up on my iPhone as I was driving. But you just asked it, brought me back to one of the things that tied into was in the first reading, those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas, and how the process that as a human, as a being in the world, you're not going to stop being a human being. So that you can't get out of preferences. That's another delusion to think that you're suddenly, some metaphysical being. And it says here, the world we live in is in the world we create based on how our mind encounters the myriad dharmas. We cannot prevent our minds from creating the world as it does, but it is possible to realize that the world out of our creation does not reflect true reality. And practicing with this realization and letting go of the rigid belief in the narrative preferences of our minds is opening the hand of thoughts.
Yes.
Close to that kind of living. To me, it seemed like that was tying into.
And think about how that applies to relationships, especially the difficult ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can't change what's going on, but you can live within that moment.
Right.
Yeah.
And we know that nobody is seeing absolute reality. Even when we're so sure that it's us, that it's me who's seeing absolute reality, nobody is. And that's what Okamura is talking about, being able to see through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think we lost the second part of that question, which was really good about moral views. And
yes,
you talked
thank
about this
you.
A little bit before, but this is an endlessly interesting theme,
yeah,
right? So
yeah,
how do you accept things, but what if there's something that you feel demands action, right?
So is it that you feel demands action, or is
or
it
that it's morally wrong? Or
morally
or
wrong.
Right.
Well, the Buddhist take on this, which I find helpful, some people don't, but I find helpful, is that it is about skillfulness or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so that their idea is that there's no, that morally wrong, there are people who say all kinds of things are morally wrong that I think are fine, right? Like who you love. There are people who really get into being judgmental about that. And for me, that's completely irrelevant, as long as there's love, right? So, but the skillful means is something that I find very helpful. The Buddha said, basically, if we know over millennia of human endeavors that killing needlessly, and killing other people does not... is not skillful. It makes for suffering. That taking what's not freely offered makes for suffering. That misusing sex, all those that speaking ill of others makes for suffering. What he's saying is that these guidelines really help to reduce suffering in the world. So they're meant to be guidelines. I don't know if that kind of gets at your question, but. So that we can step up and do skillful actions to try to reduce suffering, which is different from insisting that certain things are...
Right. Yeah.
Is it that the... it seems like the recurring theme is that when you take it personally, so to speak, that is where the problem lies, is that it becomes a personal affront.
Yeah.
Rather than you could have, you're saying, terming it skillful, other people might call it immoral. But if someone is, needless killing, there's a prohibition on needless killing, that's a moral choice. But you can act on that. You can be skillful, and this spoke. You can act on that skillfully, and try to redress wrongs, so to speak, without it being a personal affront.
Yes.
That's sort of the difference. Is it, in as much as it's not, you're not taking it in as an affront to you.
Right. Right. And because from the point of view of emptiness or oneness, it's all the same, that there's no affront to me any more than there's an affront to you. There's just suffering to be relieved, or there's a damaging action to be prevented if possible, or because all of us are so interconnected that your suffering is also mine. Yeah.
Bob, I noticed that you prefaced your remarks by saying something about being a bad Buddhist.
Yeah.
And I understood a little later in your talk what you were referring to, and I was glad you added that piece, because what you said was it's important to have, or you can learn from having, beginner's mind in relation to the unpleasant manifestations of others. But in these situations, our own manifestation is also unpleasant.
Absolutely.
And for me, that's half of the difficulty.
Yeah.
Maybe the bigger half.
Yeah.
And so to remember that that is also the Buddha, even though I'm not behaving like the ideal Buddhist that
yes.
I imagine myself to be, that is also the Buddha.
Exactly.
That is also an attachment.
Exactly. That's so important. And this is how I'm, you know, this is how I'm showing up right now, as a snarling, unhappy host of my cousin. You know, it's like, this is, and that I did, you know, I was definitely saying I'm a bad Buddhist in quotes, because clearly that's a story I'm telling myself, right?
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right, that too is it, these
yeah.
stories we tell ourselves about.
And it occurs to me that there may be a connection between what you said and the reading from Realizing Genjo Koan, which it was wonderful to hear, and I think you chose that for tonight also.
Actually, I didn't. Susan did.
Oh,
and when I when you read it, it was like, yes.
Yeah. But because he emphasizes the way in which our practice is, or let me say my practice, is most often a kind of personal project that I am working on.
Mm.
And he just points out that that is not what Zazen is.
Right.
That it is something that involves us all, or involves the one, as it were. And so, you know, that relates back to the personal affront that I have, not only with somebody else's behavior, but also with my own.
Right.
And why should that be so offensive to me, in the light of the fact that, you know, I'm just a part of it?
It's just that we are just the universe-universe-ing, as Josh likes to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if I'm being a jerk, that's the universe-universe-ing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Anyway, thank you, Bob.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
But you don't continue being a jerk. In the I mean, in realizing that what's going on for me is going on for you is all part of this big thing that goes on. It's like learning how not to act. Do you know, like,
yes.
How to, now I have a brother in your category, and we always get into it. And what I find, the only time, and recently we don't fight, is because it usually has to come from me, because he's so convinced he's going to convince me otherwise, and
yeah.
It's usually politically.
Yeah.
And I find the thing that always brings it is like remembering the humanity in each other.
Mm-hmm.
If I can do that, it's like, this is Tony being Tony. And I say, you know, Tony, no, we can't talk about these things. And it does. It feels like we really can't talk about these things. But we can talk about so many other things and remember that we love each other.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you can bring it to that, then you really realize that the other stuff is just, you know, me doing my thing and he's doing his thing. And you sort of have to go beyond words.
Yeah.
You really have to, I feel that way. And we have a friend, the same thing happened. We were so close, my husband and I were, you know, we were, you know, hippies together.
Mm.
And along came the Clinton administration, where he became crazy politically, and we could no longer be in the same room. because he got so upset, and we couldn't get over the transformation of this man. So we did not speak for years. And my husband, though, kept calling him every for his birthday, leave a message, happy birthday, Joe. And then one day, out of the blue, Joe invites us for dinner. Mm. I thought, I can't possibly go to dinner. Well, we got the whole evening together in the restaurant. And it was really difficult. But again, then he invited us again. Again, it was connecting the humanity in Joe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we found that we had a really lovely evening. We just couldn't talk about ideas, because ideas are just our own stories that we have learned. We just were enjoying each other.
You could just be together.
To be together. Yeah. And I don't know, it just feels, again, to me it's always about seeing the compassion. It's about compassion for the other person and compassion for myself.
Right. Right. And that's what the looking, and that's what, you know, what happens is when we lose that, we start looking away and we start trying to exclude and shut out both the other person and our own reactions, because we don't like any of it.
No, exactly.
And it's when, and the thing about practice is it keeps pointing us back to toward exactly what we're trying to leave out.
Mm.
And that's when you begin to say, oh, this person is really suffering.
Yeah, we're all
like
suffering.
Like me.
We're all suffering.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Really.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Many things remind me of child rearing, and that, you know, we're able, most of us, at least some of the time, to see children, driving us crazy with behavior, and to say, well, he hadn't had anything to eat since 2 o'clock, or,
yeah,
you know, he's been up for it, so, and needs to rest, and I don't think we have those, we don't think in those terms about grown-ups,
mm-hmm,
but they want something too.
Exactly.
And they may,
yeah,
not even know what it is,
yeah,
but there's something they want.
Yeah.
And there's, I don't think, I've listened to so many political harangues, and I don't think that those people have any expectation that they're going to convince me of what they're saying. I think they're smart enough to know that. But they want something from me. And if you can just try to think, you know, what could this person, do they just want a little tender care?
Mm-hmm.
Do they just want attention? Do they want to be, you know, thought important in the group that's here?
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah.
But it is something that could be maybe without being morally offensive, could be,
yeah,
extended to the person if you could just get past, which is hard. I mean, it's just like it's hard with a kid yelling at you and you're trying to do two or three other things. But there's something real that might be supplied,
right,
that,
right,
would make that person less upset.
Yeah. And getting some sense of this person being a person who's wanting something,
mm-hmm,
maybe afraid of something,
mm-hmm,
or just, you know, and being able to connect with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's where the interconnectedness becomes,
mm-hmm,
very concrete and,
mm-hmm,
specific. All right. Shall we make our vows?
On the last page.